It's only because you come to me with the highest recommendation from my very good friend and colleague, Franklin, Alan Franklin, prompted Kate to save the psychologist from having to open his drawer again. Alan Franklin was a therapist whom Kate had seen for a few sessions after the loss of her husband, Luke. He had warned her that Standish, though brilliant, was also peculiar, even by the high standards set by his profession. Franklin, resumed Standish, that I agreed to see you. Let me warn you instantly that if I see any resumption of this something nasty in the woodshead mendacity appearing in the papers as a result of this interview, I will do such things what they are yet I know not, but they shall be the terror of the earth, said Kate brightly. Standish narrowed his eyes. Lear, Act 2, Scene 4, he said, and I think you'll find it's terrors and not terror. Do you know, I think you're right, replied Kate. Thank you, Alan, she thought. She smiled at Standish, who relaxed into pleased superiority. It was odd, Kate reflected, that people who needed to bully you were the easiest to push around. So you would like to know precisely what, Miss Schechter? Assume, said Kate, that I know nothing. Standish smiled as if to signify that no assumption could possibly give him greater pleasure. Very well, he said. The Woodshead is a research hospital. We specialise in the care and study of patients with unusual or previously unknown conditions, largely in the psychological or psychiatric fields. Funds are raised in various ways. One of our chief methods is quite simply to take in private patients at exorbitantly high fees, which they are happy to pay, or at least happy to complain about. There is, in fact, nothing to complain about, because patients who come to us privately are made fully aware of why our fees are so high. For the money they are paying, they are, of course, perfectly entitled to complain. The right to complain is one of the privileges they are paying for. In some cases, we come to a special arrangement under which, in return for being made the sole beneficiaries of a patient's estate, we will guarantee to look after that patient for the rest of his or her life. So, in effect, you are in the business of giving scholarships to people with particularly gifted diseases. Exactly. A very good way of expressing it. We are in the business of giving scholarships to people with particularly gifted diseases. I must make a note of that. Miss Mayhew! He had opened a drawer which clearly contained his office intercom. In response to his summons, one of the cupboards opened and turned out to be a door into a side office, a feature which must have appealed to some architect who had conceived an ideological dislike of doors. From this office there emerged obediently a thin and rather blank-faced woman in her mid-40s. "Miss Mayhew," said Mr. Standish, "we are in the business of giving scholarships to people with particularly gifted diseases." "Very good, Mr. Standish," said Miss Mayhew, and retreated backwards into her office, pulling the door closed after her. Kate wondered if it was perhaps a cupboard after all. "And we do have some patients with some really quite outstanding diseases at the moment," enthused the psychologist. "Perhaps you'd care to come and see one or two of our current stars."
"Indeed I would. That would be most interesting, Mr. Standish. You're very kind," said Kate.
"You have to be kind in this job," Standish replied, and flicked a smile on and off at her. Kate was trying to keep some of the impatience she was feeling out of her manner. She did not take to Mr. Standish, and was beginning to feel that there was a kind of Martian quality to him. Furthermore, the only thing she was actually interested in was discovering whether or not the hospital had accepted a new admission in the early hours of the morning, and if so, where he was and whether she could see him. She had originally tried the direct approach, but had been rebuffed by a mere telephone receptionist on the grounds that she didn't have a name to ask for. Simply asking if they had any tall, well-built blonde men in residence had seemed to create entirely the wrong impression. At least, she insisted to herself that it was entirely the wrong impression. A quick phone call to Alan Franklin had set her up for this altogether more subtle approach. "Good!" A look of doubt passed momentarily over Mr. Standish's face, and he summoned Miss Mayhew from out of her cupboard again. "Miss Mayhew, that last thing I just said to you..."
"Yes, Mr. Standish?"
"I assume you realise that I wish you to make a note of it for me."
"No, Mr. Standish, but I will be happy to do so."
"Thank you," said Mr. Standish, with a slightly tense look. "And tidy up in here, please. The place looks,
He wanted to say that the place looked a mess, but was frustrated by its air of clinical sterility.
"Just tidy up, generally," he concluded.
"Yes, Mr. Standish."
The psychologist nodded tersely, brushed a non-existent speck of dust off the top of his desk, flicked another brief smile on and off at Kate, and then escorted her out of his office and into the corridor, which was immaculately laid out with the sort of beige carpet which gave everyone who walked on it electric shocks. "Here, you see," said Standish, indicating part of the wall they were walking past with an idle wave of his hand, but not making it in any way clear what it was he wished her to see, or what she was supposed to understand from it. "And this," he said, apparently pointing at a door hinge. "Ah!" he added, as the door swung open towards them. Kate was alarmed to find herself giving a little expectant start every time a door opened anywhere in this place. This was not the sort of behaviour she expected of a worldly-wise New Yorker journalist, even if she didn't actually live in New York and only wrote travel articles for magazines. It was still not right for her to be looking for large blonde men every time a door opened. There was no large blonde man. There was instead a small, sandy-haired girl of about 10 years old,
being pushed along in a wheelchair. She seemed very pale, sick, and withdrawn, and was murmuring something soundlessly to herself. Whatever it was she was murmuring seemed to cause her worry and agitation, and she would flop this way, then that, in her chair, as if trying to escape from the words coming out of her mouth. Kate was instantly moved by the sight of her, and, on an impulse, asked the nurse who was pushing her along to stop. She squatted down to look kindly into the girl's face, which seemed to please the nurse a little, but Mr. Standish less so. Kate did not try to demand the girl's attention, merely gave her an open and friendly smile to see if she wanted to respond. But the girl seemed unwilling or unable to. Her mouth worked away endlessly, appearing almost to lead an existence that was independent of the rest of her face. Now that Kate looked at her more closely, it seemed that she looked not so much sick and withdrawn as weary, harassed, and unutterably fed up. She needed a little rest. She needed peace. But her mouth kept motoring on. For a fleeting instant, her eyes caught Kate's, and the message Kate received was along the lines of, "I'm sorry, but you'll just have to excuse me while all this is going on." The girl took a deep breath, half closed her eyes in resignation, and continued her relentless, silent murmuring. Kate leant forward a little in an attempt to catch any actual words, but she couldn't make anything out. She shot an inquiring look up at Standish. He said simply, "Stock market prices." A look of amazement crept over Kate's face. Standish added with a wry shrug, "Yesterday's, I'm afraid." Kate flinched at having her reaction so wildly misinterpreted, and hurriedly looked back at the girl in order to cover her confusion. "You mean," she said rather redundantly, "she's just sitting here reciting yesterday's stock market prices?" The girl rolled her eyes past Kate's. "Yes," said Standish. "It took a lip reader to work out what was going on. We all got rather excited, of course, but then closer examination revealed they were in yesterday's, which is a bit of a disappointment. Not that significant a case, really. Aberrant behaviour. Interesting to know why she does it, but..." "Hold on a moment," said Kate, trying to sound very interested rather than absolutely horrified. "Are you saying that she is reciting, what, the closing prices over and over, or—" "No. That's an interesting feature, of course. She pretty much keeps pace with the movements in the market over the course of a whole day, just 24 hours out of step."
"But that's extraordinary, isn't it?"
"Oh, yes, quite a feat."
"A feat?"
"Well, as a scientist, I have to take the view that, since the information is freely available, she is acquiring it through normal channels. There's no necessity in this case to invent any supernatural or paranormal dimension. Occam's razor. Shouldn't needlessly multiply entities."
"But has anyone seen her studying the newspapers or copying stuff down over the phone?"
She looked up at the nurse, who shook her head dumbly. "No, never actually caught her at it," said Standish. "As I say, it's quite a feat. I'm sure a stage magician or memory man could tell you how it was done."
"Have you asked one?"
"No, don't hold with such people."
"But do you really think she could possibly be doing this deliberately?" insisted Kate.
"Believe me, if you understood as much about people as I do, Miss, you would believe anything," said Standish, in his most professionally reassuring tone of voice. Kate stared into the tired, wretched face of the young girl and said nothing. "You have to understand," said Standish, "that we have to be rational about this. If it was tomorrow's stock market prices, it would be a different story. That would be a phenomenon of an entirely different character, which would merit and demand the most rigorous study. And I'm sure we'd have no difficulty in funding the research. There would be absolutely no problem about that." "I see," said Kate, and meant it. She stood up a little stiffly and brushed down her skirt. "So," she said, and she felt ashamed of herself, "who is your newest patient? Who has arrived most recently, then?" She shuddered at the crassness of the non sequitur, but reminded herself that she was there as a journalist, so it would not seem odd. Standish waved the nurse and the wheelchair with its sad charge on their way. Kate glanced back at the girl once, and then followed Standish through the swing doors and into the next section of corridor, which was identical to the previous one. "Here, you see," said Standish again, this time apparently in relation to a window frame. "And this," he said, pointing at a light.
He had obviously either not heard her question, or was deliberately ignoring it. Perhaps, thought Kate, he was simply treating it with the contempt it deserved. It suddenly dawned on her what all this "here, you see," and "thising" was about. He was asking her to admire the quality of the decor. The windows were sashes, with finely made and beautifully painted beads. The light fittings were of a heavy, dull metal, probably nickel-plated, and so on. "Very fine," she said accommodatingly. "Nice place you've got here," she added, thinking that that would please him. It did. He allowed himself a subdued beam of pleasure.
"We like to think of it as a quality, caring environment," he said.
"You must get a lot of people wanting to come here," Kate continued, plugging away at her theme. "How often do you admit new patients? When was the last?" With her left hand, she carefully restrained her right hand, which wanted to strangle her at this moment. A door they were passing was slightly ajar, and she tried, unobtrusively, to look in.
"Very well, we'll take a look in here," said Standish immediately, pushing the door fully open on what transpired to be quite a small room.
Ah, yes, Standish said, recognizing the occupant. He ushered Kate in. The occupant of the room was another non-large, non-blonde person. Kate was beginning to find the whole visit to be something of an emotionally wearing experience, and she had a feeling that things were not about to ease up in that respect. The man sitting in the bedside chair, while his bed was being made up by a hospital orderly, was one of the most deeply and disturbingly tousled people that Kate had ever seen. In fact, it was only his hair that was tousled, but it was tousled to such an extreme degree that it seemed to draw all of his long face up into its distressed chaos. He seemed quite content to sit where he was, but there was something tremendously vacant about his contentedness. He seemed literally to be content about nothing. There was a completely empty space hanging in the air about 18 inches in front of his face, and his contentedness, if it sprang from anything, sprang from staring at that. There was also a sense that he was waiting for something, whether it was something that was about to happen at any moment, or something that was going to happen later in the week, or even something that was going to happen some little while after hell iced over and British Telecom got the phones fixed, was by no means apparent, because it seemed to be all the same to him. If it happened, he was ready for it, and if it didn't, he was content. Kate found such contentedness almost unbearably distressing. "What's the matter with him?" she said quietly, and then instantly realized that she was talking as if he wasn't there, when he could probably speak perfectly well for himself. Indeed, at that moment he suddenly did speak. Oh, hi, he said. Yeah, thank you. Hello, she said in response, though it didn't seem quite to fit. Or rather, what he had said didn't seem quite to fit. Standish made a gesture to her, to discourage her from speaking. Yeah, a bagel would be fine, said the contented man. He said it in a flat kind of tone, as if merely repeating something he had been given to say. Yeah, and maybe some juice, he added. Okay, thanks. He then relaxed into his state of empty watchfulness. A very unusual condition, said Standish. That is to say, we can only believe that it is entirely unique. I've certainly never heard of anything remotely like it. It has also proved virtually impossible to verify beyond doubt that it is what it appears to be, so I'm glad to say we've been spared the embarrassment of attempting to give the condition a name. Would you like me to help Mr. Elwes back to bed? Asked the orderly of Standish. Standish nodded. He didn't bother to waste words on minions. The orderly bent down to talk to the patient. Mr. Elwes, he said quietly. Mr. Elwes seemed to swim up out of a reverie. Hmm? He said, and suddenly looked round. He seemed confused. Oh, what? He said faintly. Would you like me to help you back to bed? Oh, thank you, yes, that would be kind. Though clearly dazed and bewildered, Mr. Elwes was quite able to get himself back into bed, and all the orderly needed to supply was reassurance and encouragement. Once Mr. Elwes was well settled, the orderly nodded politely to Standish and Kate, and made his exit. Mr. Elwes quickly lapsed back into his trance-like state, lying propped up against an escarpment of pillows. His head dropped forward slightly, and he stared at one of his knees, poking up bonily from under the covers. "Get me New York," he said. Kate shot a puzzled glance at Standish, hoping for some kind of explanation, but got none. "Oh, okay," said Mr. Elwes. "It's 541-something. Hold on." He spoke another four digits of a number in his dead-flat voice. "What is happening here?" asked Kate at last. "It took us rather a long time to work it out. It was only quite by the remotest chance that someone discovered it. That television was on in the room." He pointed to the small portable set off to one side of the bed. "Tuned to one of those chat program things which happened to be going out live. Most extraordinary thing. Mr. Elwes was sitting here muttering about how much he hated the BBC. Don't know if it was the BBC, perhaps it was one of those other channels they have now. And was expressing an opinion about the host of the program, to the effect that he considered him to be a rectum of some kind, and saying furthermore that he wished the whole thing was over, and that, yes, all right, he was coming. And then suddenly, what he was saying and what was on the television began in some extraordinary way almost to synchronize." I don't understand what you mean, said Kate. I'd be surprised if you did, said Standish. Everything that Elwes said was then said just a moment later on the television by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Dustin Hoffman. It seems that Mr. Elwes here knows everything that this Mr. Hoffman is going to say just a second or so before he says it. It is not, I have to say, something that Mr. Hoffman would be very pleased about if he knew. Attempts have been made to alert the gentleman to the problem, but he has proved to be somewhat difficult to reach. "Just what the shit is going on here?" asked Mr. Elwes placidly. Mr. Hoffman is, we believe, currently making a film on location somewhere on the west coast of America. He looked at his watch.
I think he's probably just woken up in his hotel and is making his early morning phone calls," he added.
Kate was gazing with astonishment between Standish and the extraordinary Mr. Elwes. How long has the poor man been like this?
Oh, about 5 years, I think. Started absolutely out of the blue. He was sitting having dinner with his family one day, as usual, when suddenly he started complaining about his caravan, and then shortly afterwards about how he was being shot. He then spent the entire night talking in his sleep, repeating the same apparently meaningless phrases over and over again, and also saying he didn't think much of the way they were written. It was a very trying time for his family, as you can imagine, living with such a perfectionist actor and not even realizing it. It now seems very surprising how long it took them to identify what was occurring, particularly when he once woke them all up in the early hours of the morning to thank them and the producer and the director for his Oscar.
Kate, who didn't realize that the day was still only softening her up for what was to come, made the mistake of thinking that it had just reached a climax of shock. "The poor man," she said in a hushed voice. "What a pathetic state to be in. He's just living as someone else's shadow."
"I don't think he's in any pain."
Mr. Elwes appeared to be quietly locked in a bitter argument, which seemed to touch on the definitions of the words points, gross, profits, and limo.
"But the implications of this are extraordinary, aren't they?" said Kate. "He's actually saying these things moments before Dustin Hoffman."
"Well, it's all conjecture, of course. We've only got a few clear instances of absolute correlation, and we just haven't got the opportunity to do more thorough research. One has to recognize that those few instances of direct correlation were not rigorously documented and could be more simply explained as coincidence. The rest could be merely the product of an elaborate fantasy."
"But if you put this case next to that of the girl we just saw..."
"Ah, well, you can't do that, you see. We have to judge each case on its own merits."
"But they're both in the same world."
But there are separate issues. Obviously, if Mr. Elwes here could demonstrate significant precognition of, for instance, the head of the Soviet Union, or better still, the President of the United States, then clearly there would be important defense issues involved, and one might be prepared to stretch a point on the question of what is and what is not coincidence and fantasy. But for a mere screen actor, that is, a screen actor with no apparent designs on political office, I think that, we have to stick to the principles of rigorous science. So," he added, turning to leave and drawing Kate with him, "I think that in the cases of both Mr. Elwes and, what was her name, the charming girl in the wheelchair, it may be that we are not able to be of much more help to them, and we may need the space and facilities for more deserving cases." Kate could think of nothing to say to this, and followed, seething dumbly.
"Ah, now here we have an altogether much more interesting and promising case," said Standish, forging on ahead through the next set of double doors. Kate was trying to keep her reactions under control, but nevertheless even someone as glassy and Martian as Mr. Standish could not help but detect that his audience was not absolutely with him. A little extra brusqueness and impatience crept into his demeanour to join forces with the large quantities of brusqueness and impatience which were already there. They paced down the corridor for a few seconds in silence. Kate was looking for other ways of casually introducing the subject of recent admissions, but was forced to concede to herself that you cannot attempt to introduce the same subject 3 times in a row without beginning to lose that vital quality of casualness. She glanced as surreptitiously as she could at each door they passed, but most were firmly closed, and the ones that were not revealed nothing of interest. She glanced out of a window as they walked past it, and noticed a van turning into a rear courtyard. It caught her attention in the brief instance that it was within her view, because it very clearly wasn't a baker's van or a laundry van. Baker's vans and laundry vans advertise their business and have words like bakery and laundry painted on them, whereas this van was completely blank. It had absolutely nothing to say to anyone, and it said it loudly and distinctly. It was a large, heavy, serious-looking van that was almost on the verge of being an actual lorry, and it was painted in a uniform dark metallic grey. It reminded Kate of the huge gunmetal grey freight lorries which thunder through Bulgaria and Yugoslavia on their way from Albania, with nothing but the word Albania stenciled on their sides. She remembered wondering what it was that the Albanians exported in such an anonymous way, but when on one occasion she had looked it up, she found that their only export was electricity, which, if she remembered her high school physics correctly, was unlikely to be moved around in lorries. The large, serious-looking van turned and started to reverse towards the rear entrance of the hospital. Whatever it was that the van usually carried, Kate thought, it was about either to pick it up or deliver it. She moved on. A few moments later, Standish arrived at a door, knocked at it gently, and looked inquiringly into the room within. He then beckoned to Kate to follow him in. This was a room of an altogether different sort. Immediately within the door was an anteroom with a very large window, through which the main room could be seen. The two rooms were clearly soundproofed from each other, because the anteroom was decked out with monitoring equipment and computers, not one of which but didn't hum loudly to itself, and the main room contained a woman lying in bed, asleep.
"Mrs. Elspeth May," said Standish, and clearly felt that he was introducing the top of the bill. Her room was obviously a very good one, spacious and furnished comfortably and expensively. Fresh flowers stood on every surface, and the bedside table, on which Mrs. May's knitting lay, was of mahogany. She herself was a comfortably shaped, silver-haired lady of late middle age, and she was lying asleep, half propped up in bed on a pile of pillows, wearing a pink, woolly cardigan. After a moment, it became clear to Kate that though she was asleep, she was by no means inactive. Her head lay back peacefully, with her eyes closed, but her right hand was clutching a pen which was scribbling away furiously on a large pad of paper which lay beside her. The hand, like the wheelchair girl's mouth, seemed to lead an independent and feverishly busy existence. Some small pinkish electrodes were taped to Mrs. May's forehead, just below her hairline, and Kate assumed that these were providing some of the readings which danced across the computer screens in the anteroom in which she and Standish stood. Two white-coated men and a woman stood monitoring the equipment, and a nurse stood watching through the window. Standish exchanged a couple of brief words with them on the current state of the patient, which was universally agreed to be excellent. Kate could not escape the impression that she ought to know who Mrs. May was, but she didn't, and was forced to ask. "She's a medium," said Standish a little crossly, "as I assumed you would know. A medium of prodigious powers. She is currently in a trance and engaged in automatic writing. She is taking dictation. Virtually every piece of dictation she receives is of inestimable value. Have you not heard of her?" Kate admitted that she had not. "Well, you are no doubt familiar with the lady who claimed that Mozart, Beethoven, and Schubert were dictating music to her."
Yes, I did hear about that. There was a lot of stuff in colour supplements about her a few years ago."
"Her claims were, well, interesting, if that's the sort of thing you're interested in. The music was certainly more consistent with what might be produced by each of those gentlemen quickly and before breakfast than it was with what you would expect from a musically unskilled middle-aged housewife." Kate could not let this pomposity pass. "That's a rather sexist viewpoint," she said. "George Eliot was a middle-aged housewife." "Yes, yes," said Standish testily, "but she wasn't taking musical dictation from the deceased Wolfgang Amadeus. That's the point I'm making. Please try and follow the logic of this argument, and do not introduce irrelevances. If I felt for a moment that the example of George Eliot could shed any light on our present problem, you could rely on me to introduce it myself. Where was I?"
"I don't know."
Mabel, Doris. What was her name? Let us call her Mabel. The point is that the easiest way of dealing with the Doris problem was simply to ignore it. Nothing very important hinged on it at all. A few concerts, second-rate material. But here, we have something of an altogether different nature."
He said this last in hushed tones and turned to study a TV monitor which stood among the bank of computer screens. It showed a close-up of Mrs. May's hand scuttling across her pad of paper. Her hand largely obscured what she had written, but it appeared to be mathematics of some kind.
"Mrs. May is, or so she claims, taking dictation from some of the greatest physicists, from Einstein and from Heisenberg and Planck, and it is very hard to dispute her claims, because the information being produced here, by automatic writing, by this untutored lady, is in fact physics of a very profound order. From the late Einstein we are getting more and more refinements to our picture of how time and space work at a macroscopic level, and from the late Heisenberg and Planck we are increasing our understanding of the fundamental structures of matter at a quantum level. And there is absolutely no doubt that this information is edging us closer and closer towards the elusive goal of a grand unified field theory of everything. Now this produces a very interesting, not to say somewhat embarrassing, situation for scientists, because the means by which the information is reaching us seems to be completely contrary to the meaning of the information."
"It's like Uncle Henry," said Kate suddenly.
Standish looked at her blankly.
"Uncle Henry thinks he's a chicken," Kate explained.
Standish looked at her blankly again.
"You must have heard it," said Kate.
"We're terribly worried about Uncle Henry. He thinks he's a chicken. Well, why don't you send him to the doctor?"
"Well, we would, only we need the eggs."
Standish looked at her as if a small but perfectly formed elderberry tree had suddenly sprung unbidden from the bridge of her nose.
"Say that again," he said in a small, shocked voice.
"What, all of it?"
"All of it."
Kate stuck her fist on her hip and said it again, doing the voices with a bit more dash and southern accents this time.
"That's brilliant," Standish breathed when she had done.
"You must have heard it before," she said, a little surprised by this response. "It's an old joke."
"No," he said, "I have not. We need the eggs. We need the eggs. We need the eggs. We can't send him to the doctor because we need the eggs. Astounding insight into the central paradoxes of the human condition and of our indefatigable facility for constructing adaptive rationales to account for it. Good God! Kate shrugged. And you say this is a joke? Demanded Standish incredulously. Yes, it's very old, really. And are they all like that? I never realized. Well, I'm astounded, said Standish, utterly astounded. I thought that jokes were things that fat people said on television. I never listened to them. I feel that people have been keeping something from me. Nurse! The nurse, who had been keeping watch on Mrs. May through the window, jumped at being barked at unexpectedly like this. Yes, Mr. Standish, she said. You clearly made her nervous. Why have you never told me any jokes? The nurse stared at him and quivered at the impossibility of even knowing how to think about answering such a question. Well, make a note of it, will you? In future I will require you and all other staff in this hospital to tell me all the jokes you have at your disposal. Is that understood? Yes, Mr. Standish. Standish looked at her with doubt and suspicion. You do know some jokes, do you, nurse? He challenged her. Yes, Mr. Standish. I think, yes, I do. Tell me one. What, now, Mr. Standish? This instant. There's one which is that a patient wakes up after having... Well, that is, he's been to surgery, and he wakes up, and it's not very good. But anyway, he's been to surgery, and he says to the doctor when he wakes up, Doctor, doctor, what's wrong with me? I can't feel my legs. And the doctor says, Yes, I'm afraid we've had to amputate both your arms. And that's it, really. That's why he couldn't feel his legs, you see. Mr. Standish looked at her levelly for a moment or two. You're on report, nurse, he said. Yes, Mr. Standish. He turned to Kate. Isn't there one about a chicken crossing a road or some such thing? Yes, said Kate doubtfully. She felt she was caught in a bit of a situation here. And how does that one go? Well, said Kate, it goes, why did the chicken cross the road? Yes, and? And the answer is, to get to the other side. I see. Standish considered things for a moment. And what does this chicken do when it arrives at the other side of the road? History does not relate, replied Kate promptly. I think that falls outside the scope of the joke, which really only concerns itself with the journey of the chicken across the road and the chicken's reasons for making it. It's a little like a Japanese haiku in that respect. Kate suddenly found she was enjoying herself. She managed to wink surreptitiously at the nurse, who had no idea what to make of anything at all. I see, said Standish once again, and frowned. And do these, jokes require the preparatory use of any form of artificial stimulant? It depends on the joke, depends on who it's being told to. Hmm. Well, I must say, you've certainly opened up a rich furrow for me, Miss, it seems to me that the whole field of humour could benefit from close and immediate scrutiny. Clearly, we need to sort out the jokes which have any kind of genuine psychological value from those which are merely encouraged drug abuse and should be stopped. Good. He turned to address the white-coated researcher, who was studying the TV monitor on which Mrs. May's scribblings were being tracked. Anything fresh of value for Mr. Einstein? He asked. The researcher did not move his eyes from the screen. He replied, It says, How would you like your eggs, poached or boiled? Again Standish paused. Interesting, he said, very interesting. Continue to make a careful note of everything she writes. Come. This last he said to Kate, and made his way out of the room. Very strange people, physicists, he said, as soon as they were outside again. In my experience, the ones who aren't actually dead are in some way very ill. Well, the afternoon presses on, and I'm sure that you're keen to get away and write your article, Miss, I certainly have things urgently awaiting my attention, and patients awaiting my care. So if you have no more questions... There is just one thing, Mr. Standish. Kate decided to hell with it. We need to emphasize that it's up to the minute. Perhaps if you could spare a couple more minutes, we could go and see whoever is your most recent admission. I think that'd be a little tricky. Our last admission was about a month ago, and she died of pneumonia 2 weeks after admission. Well, perhaps that isn't so thrilling. So, no new admissions in the last couple of days? No admissions of anyone particularly large or blonde or Nordic? With a fur coat or a sledgehammer, perhaps? I mean, just for instance? An inspiration struck her. A readmission, perhaps? Standish regarded her with deepening suspicion. Miss Schechter. Miss Schechter, I begin to get the impression that your interests in the hospital are not... He was interrupted at that moment by the swing doors just behind them in the corridor being pushed open. He looked up to see who it was, and as he did so his manner changed. He motioned Kate sharply to stand aside while a large trolley bed was wheeled through the doors by an orderly. A sister and another nurse followed in attendance, and gave the impression that they were an entourage in a procession, rather than merely nurses about their normal business. The occupant of the trolley was a delicately frail old man, with skin like finely veined parchment. The rear section of the trolley was inclined upwards at a very slight angle, so that the old man could survey the world as it passed him. and he surveyed it with a kind of quiet, benevolent horror. His mouth hung open gently, and his head lolled very slightly, so that every slightest bump in the progress of the trolley caused it to roll a little to one side or the other. Yet, in spite of his fragile listlessness, the air he emanated was that of very quietly, very gently, owning everything. It was the one eye which conveyed this. Each thing it rested on, whether it was the view through a window, or the nurse who was holding back the door so that the trolley could move through it without impediment, or whether it was on Mr. Standish, who suddenly was all obsequious charm and obeisance, all seemed instantly gathered up into the domain ruled by that eye. Kate wondered for a moment how it was that eyes conveyed such an immense amount of information about their owners. They were, after all, merely spheres of white gristle. They hardly changed as they got older, apart from getting a little redder and a bit runnier. The iris opened and closed a bit, but that was all. Where did all this flood of information come from? Particularly in the case of a man with only one of them, and only a sealed-up flap of skin in place of the other. She was interrupted in this line of thought by the fact that at that instant the eye in question moved on from Standish and settled on her. The grip it exerted was so startling that she almost yelped. With the frailest of faint motions, the old man signalled to the orderly who was pushing the trolley to pause. The trolley drew to a halt, and when the noise of its rolling wheels was stilled, there was, for a moment, no other noise to be heard other than the distant hum of an elevator. Then the elevator stopped. Kate returned his look with a little smiling frown, as if to say, "Sorry, do I know you?" and then wondered to herself if in fact she did. There was some fleeting familiarity about his face, but she couldn't quite catch it. She was impressed to notice that though this was only a trolley bed he was in, the bed linen that his hands lay on was real linen, freshly laundered and ironed. Mr. Standish coughed slightly and said, "Miss, this is one of our most valued and cherished patients, Mr.—" "Are you quite comfortable, Mr. Odwin?" interrupted the sister helpfully. But there was no need. This was one patient whose name Standish most certainly knew. Odin quieted her with the slightest of gestures. "Mr. Odwin," said Standish, "this is Miss—" Kate was about to introduce herself once more, when she was suddenly taken completely by surprise. "I know exactly who she is," said Odin in a quiet but distinct voice, and there was in his eye for a moment the sense of an aerosol looking meaningfully at a wasp. She tried to be very formal and English. "I'm afraid," she said stiffly, "that you have the advantage of me." "Yes," said Odin. He gestured to the orderly, and together they resumed their leisurely passage down the corridor. Glances were exchanged between Standish and the sister, and then Kate was startled to notice that there was someone else standing in the corridor there with them. He had not presumably appeared there by magic. He had merely stood still when the trolley moved on, and his height, or rather his lack of it, was such that he had simply hitherto been hidden behind it. Things had been much better when he had been hidden. There are some people you like immediately, some whom you think you might learn to like in the fullness of time, and some that you simply want to push away from you with a sharp stick. It was instantly apparent into which category, for Kate, the person of Torag fell. He grinned and stared at her, or rather appeared to stare at some invisible fly darting around her head. He ran up, and before she could prevent him, grabbed hold of her right hand in his, and shook it wildly up and down. "I, too, have the advantage of you, Miss Schechter," he said, and gleefully skipped away up the corridor. The large, serious-looking grey van moved slowly down the driveway, emerged through the stone gates, and dipped sedately as it turned off the gravel and onto the asphalt of the public road. The road was a windy country lane, lined with the wintry silhouettes of leafless oaks and dead elms. Grey clouds were piled as high as pillows in the sky. The van made its stately progress away down the lane, and soon was lost among its further twists and turns. A few minutes later, the yellow Citroën made its less stately appearance between the gates. It turned its splayed wheels up onto the camber of the lane, and set off at a slow but difficult rate in the same direction. Kate was rattled. The last few minutes had been rather unpleasant. Standish was clearly an oddly behaved man at the best of times, but after their encounter with the patient named Odwin, he had turned unequivocally hostile. It was the frightening hostility of one who was himself frightened. Of what? Kate did not know. Who was she? He had demanded to know. How had she wheedled a reference out of Alan Franklin, a respected man in the profession? What was she after? What, and this seemed to be the big one, had she done to arouse the disapprobation of Mr. Odwin? She held the car grimly to the road as it negotiated the bends with considerable difficulty, and the straight sections with only slightly less. The car had landed her in court on one occasion, when one of its front wheels had sailed off on a little expedition of its own and nearly caused an accident. The police witness in the court had referred to her beloved Citroën as the alleged car, and the name had subsequently stuck. She was particularly fond of the alleged car for many reasons. If one of its doors, for instance, fell off, she could put it back on herself, which is more than you could say for a BMW. She wondered if she looked as pale and wan as she felt. But the rearview mirror was rattling around under the seat, so she was spared the knowledge. Standish himself had become quite white and shaky at the very idea of anybody crossing Mr. Odwin, and had dismissed out of hand Kate's attempts to deny that she knew anything of him at all. If that were the case, he had demanded of her, why then had Mr. Odwin made it perfectly clear that he knew her? Was she accusing Mr. Odwin of being a liar? If she was, then she should have a care for herself. Kate did not know. The encounter with Mr. Odwin was completely inexplicable to her, but she could not deny to herself that the man packed some kind of punch. When he looked at you, you stayed looked at. But beneath the disturbing quality of his steady gaze had lain some even more disturbing undercurrents. They were more disturbing because they were the undercurrents of weakness and fear. And as for the other creature, clearly he was the cause of the stories that had arisen recently in the more extremely abhorrent sectors of the tabloid press about there being something nasty in the Wood's Head. The stories had, of course, been offensive and callously insensitive, and had largely been ignored by everybody in the country, except for those very few millions who were keen on offensive and callously insensitive things. The stories had claimed that people in the area had been terrorized by some repulsively deformed, goblin-like creature, who regularly broke out of the Wood's Head and committed an impressively wide range of unspeakable acts. Like most people, Kate had assumed, insofar as she had thought about it at all, that what had actually happened was that some poor, bewildered mental patient had wandered out of the grounds and given a couple of passing old ladies a bit of a turn, and that the slavering hacks of Wapping had done the rest. Now she was a little more shaky and a little less sure. It had known her name. What could she make of that? What she made of it was a wrong turning. In her preoccupation, she missed the turning that would take her onto the main road back to London, and then had to work out what to do about it. She could simply do a three-point turn and go back, but it was a long time since she had last put the car into reverse gear, and she was frankly a bit nervous about how it would take to it. She tried taking the next two right turns to see if that would set her straight, but she had no great hopes of this actually working, and was right not to have. She drove on for 2 or 3 miles, knowing that she was on the wrong road, but at least, judging from the position of the lighter grey smear in the grey clouds, going in the right direction. After a while, she settled down to this new route. A couple of signposts she passed made it clear to her that she was merely taking the B route back to London now, which she was perfectly happy to do. If she had thought about it in advance, she would probably have chosen to do so anyway, in preference to the busy trunk road. The trip had been a total failure, and she would have done far better simply to have stayed soaking in the bath all afternoon. The whole experience had been thoroughly disturbing, verging on the frightening, and she had drawn a complete blank as far as her actual objective was concerned. It was bad enough having an objective that she could hardly bring herself to admit to, without having it completely fall apart on her as well. A sense of stale futility gradually closed in on her, along with the general greyness of the sky. She wondered if she was going very slightly mad. Her life seemed to have drifted completely out of her control in the last few days, and it was distressing to realize just how fragile her grip was, when it could so easily be shattered by a relatively minor thunderbolt or meteorite or whatever it was. The word thunderbolt seemed to have arrived in the middle of that thought without warning, and she didn't know what to make of it, so she just let it lie there at the bottom of her mind, like the towel lying on her bathroom floor that she hadn't been bothered to pick up. She longed for some sun to break through. The miles ground along under her wheels, the clouds ground her down, and she found herself increasingly thinking of penguins. At last she felt she could stand it no more, and decided that a few minutes' walk was what she needed to shake her out of her mood. She stopped the car at the side of the road, and the elderly Jaguar, which had been following her for the last 17 miles, ran straight into the back of her, which worked just as well. With a delicious shock of rage, Kate leapt, invigorated, out of her car, and ran to harangue the driver of the other car, who was, in turn, leaping out of his in order to harangue her. "Why don't you look where you're going?" she yelled at him. He was a rather overweight man, who had been driving wearing a long leather coat and a rather ugly red hat, despite the discomfort that's obviously involved. Kate warmed to him for it. "Why don't I look where I'm going?" he replied heatedly. "Don't you look in your rearview mirror?" "No," said Kate, putting her fists on her hips. "Oh," said her adversary, "why not?" "Because it's under the seat." "I see," he replied grimly. "Thank you for being so frank with me. Do you have a lawyer?"
"Yes, I do, as a matter of fact," said Kate. She said it with vim and hauteur. "Is he any good?" said the man in the hat. "I'm going to need one. Mine's popped into prison for a while."
"Well, you certainly can't have mine."
"Why not?"
"Don't be absurd. It'd be a clear conflict of interest."
Her adversary folded his arms and leant back against the bonnet of his car. It took his time to survey the surroundings. The lane was growing dim as the early winter evening began to settle on the land. He then leant into his car to turn on his hazard warning indicators. The rear amber lights winked prettily on the scrubby grass of the roadside. The front lights were buried in the rear of Kate's Citroen, and were in no fit state to wink. He resumed his leaning posture, and looked Kate up and down appraisingly. "You are a driver," he said, and I use the word in the loosest possible sense, i.e. meaning merely somebody who occupies the driving seat of what I will for the moment call, but I use the term strictly without prejudice, a car, while it is proceeding along the road, of stupendous, I would even say verging on the superhuman, lack of skill. Do you catch my drift?
No.
I mean you do not drive well. Do you know you've been all over the road for the last 17 miles?
17 miles! Exclaimed Kate. Have you been following me?
Only up to a point, said Dirk. I've tried to stay on this side of the road.
I see. Well, thank you in turn for being so frank with me. This, I need hardly tell you, is an outrage. You'd better get yourself a damn good lawyer, because mine's going to stick red-hot skewers in him.
Perhaps I should get myself a kebab instead.
You look as if you've had quite enough kebabs. May I ask you why you are following me?
You looked as if you knew where you were going, to begin with at least, for the first 100 yards or so.
What the hell's it got to do with you where I was going?
Navigational technique of mine. Kate narrowed her eyes. She was about to demand a full and instant explanation of this preposterous remark, when a passing white Ford Sierra slowed down beside them. The driver wound down the window and leant out.
"Had a crash, then?"
he shouted at them.
"Yes."
"Ha!" he said, and drove on. A second or two later, a Peugeot stopped by them.
"Who was that just now?"
the driver asked them, in reference to the previous driver who had just stopped.
"I don't know," said Dirk.
"Oh," said the driver.
"You look as if you had a crash of some sort."
"Yes," said Dirk.
"Thought so," said the driver, and drove on.
"You don't get the same quality of passers-by these days, do you?" said Dirk to Kate.
"You get hit by some real dogs, too," said Kate. "I still want to know why you are following me. You realise that it's hard for me not to see you in the role of an extremely sinister sort of person."
"That's easily explained," said Dirk. "Usually I am. On this occasion, however, I simply got lost. I was forced to take evasive action by a large grey oncoming van which took a proprietorial view of the road. I only avoided it by nipping down a side lane in which I was then unable to reverse. A few turnings later, and I was thoroughly lost. There is a school of thought which says that you should consult a map on these occasions, but to such people I merely say, ha, what if you have no map to consult? What if you have a map but is of the Dordogne? My own strategy is to find a car, or the nearest equivalent, which looks as if it knows where it's going, and follow it. I rarely end up where I was intending to go, but often I end up somewhere that I needed to be. So, what do you say to that?"
"Piffle. A robust response. I salute you.
I was going to say that I do the same thing myself sometimes, but I've decided not to admit that yet."
"Very wise," said Dirk. "You don't want to give away too much at this point. Play it enigmatic is my advice."
"I don't want your advice. Where were you trying to get to before suddenly deciding that driving 17 miles in the opposite direction would help you get there?"
"A place called the Wood's Head."
"Ah, the mental hospital.
You know it?"
"I've been driving away from it for this last 17 miles, and I wish it was further. Which ward will you be in? I need to know where to send the repair bill."
"They don't have wards," said Dirk. "And I think they would be distressed to hear you call it a mental hospital."
"Anything that distresses them is fine by me."
Dirk looked about him.
"A fine evening," he said.
"No, it isn't."
"I see," said Dirk. "You have, if I may say so, the air of one to whom her day has not been a source of joy or spiritual enrichment."
"Too damn right it hasn't," said Kate. "I've had the sort of day that would make St. Francis of Assisi kick babies, particularly if you include Tuesday in with today, which is the last time I was actually conscious. And now look, my beautiful car. The only thing I can say in favour of the whole shebang is that at least I'm not in Oslo."
"I can see how that might cheer you."
"I didn't say it cheered me. It just about stops me killing myself. I might as well save myself the bother anyway, with people like you so keen to do it for me."
"You were my able assistant, Miss Schechter."
"Stop doing that!"
"Stop doing what?"
"My name! Suddenly every stranger I meet knows my name. Would you guys please just quit knowing my name for 1 second? How can a girl be enigmatic under these conditions?
The only person I met who didn't seem to know my name was the only one I actually introduced myself to."
"All right," she said, pointing an accusing finger at Dirk. "You're not supernatural, so just tell me how you knew my name. I'm not letting go of your tie till you tell me."
"You haven't got hold of—"
"I have now, Buster."
"Unhand me."
"Why were you following me?" insisted Kate. "How do you know my name?"
"I was following you for exactly the reason stated."
As for your name, my dear lady, you practically told me yourself.
I did not.
I assure you, you did. I'm still holding your tie. If you are meant to be in Oslo, but have been unconscious since Tuesday, then presumably you were at the incredible exploding check-in counter at Heathrow Terminal 2. It was widely reported in the press. I expect you missed it through being unconscious. I myself missed it through rampant apathy, but the events of today have rather forced it on my attention. Kate grudgingly let go of his tie, but continued to eye him with suspicion.
Oh, yeah? She said. What events?
Disturbing ones, said Dirk, brushing himself down. Even if what you had told me yourself had not been enough to identify you, then the fact of your having also been today to visit the Woodshead clinched it for me. I gather from your mood of belligerent despondency that the man you were seeking was not there.
What?
Please have it, said Dirk, rapidly pulling off his tie and handing it to her.